The United States is producing a lot of its own energy at the moment. By most counts, we are still a net importer, still need to buy oil from the Middle East, for example. But the Bakken oil formation in the Dakotas puts out trainload after trainload of oil day after day. It has changed what was a sleepy part of the country into a much, much busier place. Imagine your town roughly tripling in population in this decade. That's what's happened to Williston, North Dakota. Blair Briotti tells the story of that town, its surroundings, and the people who live and work there in the new Wild West. Black gold, fracking, and life in a North Dakota boomtown. Blair Briotti is a journalist with work published in places ranging from the New York Times to Glamour magazine. She was the senior editor at the Fiscal Times and won an award 4 years ago for social justice reporting. Blair Briotti, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So did you approach this project as a social justice story or environmental or just whatever you could find?
Well, I was working at a business news site at the time, the Fiscal Times, which you mentioned, in New York. And so I think I was first initially interested in it as a business story, like what was happening economically there. You know, I was covering the recession at the time and had been covering a lot of the, you know, the tent cities that were cropping up all over the country. And then I discovered, I was looking around one day, I think I was looking for story ideas, and I was curious where in the U.S. had the lowest unemployment rate in the country, and I discovered it was Williston, North Dakota, which I hadn't heard about the oil boom happening there, so I was surprised by that. And then I learned that people were flocking there from all over the country, and there was no housing, so all these workers were living in the parking lot at Walmart and living out of their cars and tents. And so I was definitely curious about it from an economic standpoint. I mean, it reminded me of the Gold Rush or the Dust Bowl or something.
Well, yeah, and hence the reason for the name of the book, The New Wild West. It really is like that. Lots of people coming from all over the place, including you. This was not just a swoop in and swoop out. How long did you spend in the Williston area?
So I lived out there over the summer of 2013, and I lived in a trailer because I also couldn't find housing. And then I made multiple trips back and forth over about 3 years.
Give us the opening perceptions, what you saw on the ground in Williston versus any preconceived notions you might have had when you arrived.
Yeah, I mean, I feared a lot for my safety being a woman out there. I heard a lot of stories about how, you know, violence toward women had been going up. And so that, you know, I was definitely living in fear at first. But and it's not that those things weren't happening, but I think, you know, eventually I got to know a lot of the people out there. I befriended some of the workers, some of the farmers. And so just getting to know this area and how special it was, you know, especially before oil came, you know, people talked about this being this, like, wonderful place to raise a family and, you know, this really beautiful landscape. It's really close to the Badlands. There's a national park very close to Williston. So I think just seeing, you know, appreciating this area, especially before all of this industry came in and took over.
How big was Williston before anybody heard of fracking?
It was about 16,000 or 18,000 before the boom came. And then they struggled with counting exactly how many people were coming in and out, because some people would come in only for a few months and leave. And they weren't, you know, they weren't renting apartments. They weren't... There wasn't a lot of data to understand how many people were there, but I think they estimated at its peak it was about 45,000 people.
Wow, so that is easily a tripling, or close to a tripling,
right,
over the course of... And then I noticed, just looking at population figures yesterday, that's since 2010. So, I mean, this is within... The decade's not even completed yet. Wow. So when you look at it, then how closely does the story here hew to the tales of the boom towns of the Old West, the ones you mentioned, like the Gold Rush and the Comstock Lode, any of those?
Mm-hmm. How does it?
How does it compare with those? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of similarities. You know, I was reading a lot about the Gold Rush when I was out there, just to see what similarities I could come up with. You know, the difference was technology. I feel like one of the main differences was technology. People could still communicate with their loved ones back home in ways they couldn't during the Gold Rush. But other than that, I mean, there was a lot of similarities.
So the book comes around again and again to a cast of characters. In fact, if you look at the table of contents first, you blink a few times because you realize, oh, I'm seeing the same names over and over again. So give us the brief sketch of the people you chose to help tell the story of the new Wild West.
Yeah, I chose to follow five people over the course of about 3 years and just their experience going through this and really look at Williston and this area as a case study for, you know, fracking across the country. So a few people that I follow are a farmer who has about 25 oil wells on his land and what's that's like for him. I follow someone who just came to Williston to start his new life. You know, he's had a very unstable life. He struggled with alcoholism, and he didn't, you know, he was living out of his car, and just what that's like to come to a boom town to sort of try to start over. And then I also follow a female worker who's the only woman on her fracking crew and spent a lot of time with her. I follow a local pastor who's kind of struggling to maintain community in his hometown. And then I also follow an oil field wife and what it's like to try to raise a kid out there. She's living in a trailer. Her husband's gone at work most of the time, and she's trying to create stability for her family.
Is that Chelsea Niehaus?
Yes, Chelsea.
All right, we have lots to learn about all these people, the farmer, the worker, the female worker, the pastor, and the oil field wife, as we move further into Blair Briotti's book, The New Wild West, Black Gold, Fracking, and Life in a North Dakota Boomtown. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange, and if you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you when we return in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest is the journalist Blair Briotti, who got curious about what goes on in the boomtowns of the Oil West and got a chance to find out firsthand. Over the course of 3 years and an entire summer spent in Williston, North Dakota, the story she tells in The New Wild West, Black Gold, Fracking, and Life in a North Dakota Boomtown. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Questions of comment or comments about the sorts of things that you understand or would like to know more about the boomtowns of the oil country. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Just an aside, because when I first opened the book, I flipped to the middle, and boy, how hard was it to get to a drilling site, Blair?
Yeah, I struggled with a long time to try to get access. You know, I think, you know, I tried reaching out to publicity departments to see if I could get on a fracking site or an oil well site, and was denied a lot of those requests. So I eventually, after spending a lot of time with this crew, who's Cindy Marcello, the female fracker who I mentioned, she introduced me to her crew, and I spent a lot of time with them. So eventually they said, oh, yeah, we'll bring you on to this site with us. You just kind of have to lay low, and if anyone asks, don't say you're a journalist. So that's how I was able to get access.
Did you learn much there that helped tell the story for you?
Yeah, it was really great to get a sense of what it was actually like to be out there. And just, you know, they spend so much time. I mean, they're working 120-hour weeks a lot of the time.
Wow.
They're sleeping on, you know, the site. They're, you know, they're just waiting around a lot because, like, you know, various crews will come on and off the site to do different stages of the fracking process. So I really wanted to understand, you know, that part of their job.
So, I mean, do they work like a week and then get a week off? I mean, you'd kill somebody if you worked them 120 hours a week for consecutive for a long time.
Yeah, a lot of them did have two weeks on, 2 weeks off type schedules, but they also could, you know, that would be like different depending on the company you were working for. That could be adjusted. Sometimes if, you know, it was busy, they needed more workers, they would ask you to stay longer. So that wasn't really consistent, but that, especially at the beginning, that was a typical schedule.
And as we mentioned, you followed five people. Some of them work in the oil fields and some of them don't, including Donnie Nelson, who we meet first. So this was a hard part to grasp at first. So he's got this big farm. There are wells on his land and he could not stop them?
Right. That's something that a lot of people don't understand, that he doesn't own all the mineral rights below his land. And so because of that, he can't tell the oil companies he doesn't want them there. They can, you know, just because you own the surface land, so if you buy a plot of land out there, it really doesn't mean that you own what's underneath. And so an oil company can come, and they'll pay you, like, a small fee for using the land and, like, for the loss of crops. But beyond that, there's nothing you can do.
Is North Dakota unusual in severing the subsurface rights from the surface rights to land?
No, it happens in a lot of states that have had oil drilling in the past. Places like Oklahoma and Texas also do this.
Mm-hmm. So, this is sort of a major point of the book. When you use the term regulation, did you get giggles or just sort of exasperated sounds from people?
When I talk about regulation?
Yeah.
A little bit, yeah. You know, North Dakota is a conservative state, and, even the word environmentalist, you know, Donnie says, I'm not an environmentalist, I'm a conservationist. I want, you know, to protect the land, but the word environmentalist was a dirty word out there. So that was really interesting to me, especially coming from California.
Oh, sure. So let's talk about the workers. I mean, at the peak, and this, I don't know if the peak has even been arrived at yet, how fast were they coming into the Williston area?
They estimated, maybe 100 people a day were showing up to town. It was, thousands of people were arriving to this very small town, and the city really didn't know what to do with all of them. I mean, they didn't have a homeless shelter. They didn't have, enough housing. There was tons of traffic. They didn't have enough traffic lights. Like, every aspect of city life was affected, and so the town really struggled to deal with this influx of people.
It's interesting that Williston city leaders apparently did talk about a homeless shelter but opted not to build one. Why?
Right. One reason I heard was that, they worried if they built something that even more people would come and that they would be responsible for them. So they would do things like buy people bus tickets back home if they were struggling and didn't know where to live, and they came to the Salvation Army for help. Instead of being able to, find them a place to stay, they would be like, well, what we can do is just buy you a bus ticket back to where you came from.
Hmm. So did a lot of people show up in town who didn't have jobs for sure, or were most of them coming in because they had made connections and gotten hired from afar?
A lot of people just showed up to town and hoped that they could make something work. That was the most common story I heard. It was, it was rare to hear of someone that had it already set up. Maybe if they'd already been working in oil and gas, it was a lot easier for them to get a job out there. They might just be transferred. But most people, they didn't have experience in the oil field, and they were hoping, they're coming from manufacturing industries, farming, construction, and hoping to get experience out there.
Blair Briotti is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a journalist who's written about Williston, North Dakota, in the heart of the Bakken oil field. The book is called The New Wild West. So we talked about people who had been living in Walmart parking lots and living in cars and trailers and all that sort of thing. How long did it take you to find a place to live in the summer you spent there?
That's a great question. I also struggled, like I said. Even the trailer parks had waiting lists to get a plot to put your trailer on. And, I eventually found one, a little bit outside of town. I paid $800 just for this little tiny plot of gravel. And, that doesn't include the trailer. If I needed to rent a trailer, it would be a lot more than that. So I talked to my parents in Mount Shasta, California, and they had a trailer that they had been wanting to sell. And so they said, that I could use it for the summer as long as I sold it at the end of the summer. And so they helped me pull it out there from California, and we set it up on this very small plot of gravel.
I didn't realize you were right from our backyard. Are your parents home and listening to you today?
My mom probably is, yeah.
Okay. So eyes from outside, in addition to your own, Chelsea Niehaus, we mentioned, had come to town because her husband worked in the fields. After that first visit with her husband, Jacob, could she even imagine living there?
No, she did not like it when she first went out there, and she thought, yeah, this definitely isn't for me. But eventually, you know, as they lived apart for longer and, you know, some stuff back in Kentucky with her job wasn't working out, she eventually decided to give it a try for a summer. And so she packed up everything and, yeah, moved out there to live in the trailer with her husband.
And a young child, too, a son. So let's get an idea of how good the money is for oil workers. And for Jacob, for example, how different was this from what he had made at any previous job?
Right. I mean, he was working at restaurants, in construction, you know, barely able to pay his bills back in Kentucky. And then suddenly in North Dakota, he was starting at, I think it was like $60,000 a year, and that increased significantly as he stayed out there longer. So yeah, he was making close to $100,000.
And I'm curious to know, in a case like the Niehauses, is this something they had seen as a long-term thing? Did they think we'll go to Williston for good, or they think we'll go to Williston for 5 years, or had they mapped that out before he took off?
Right. I don't think they did. I think they We're giving it a try. I think Chelsea thought it would be pretty temporary, but then she saw just how much Jacob enjoyed it. I mean, I think it gave him a lot of pride and purpose, where he didn't feel that in other jobs. And so then, like, after some time passed, I think she thought, okay, this is, like, the new reality, is we're going to be an oil field family.
Which they did indeed become. We're talking about the folks in the oil field in Blair Briotti's book, The New Wild West, Black Gold, Fracking, and Life in a North Dakota Boomtown. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Questions, comments, observations of what's been going on in the Bakken oil field, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You'd mentioned having some concerns about going to one of these Wild West boomtowns. And again, some of the things about it sound very much like the character of towns on the Gold Rush and the other mineral rushes that brought people to parts of the West in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Did you have any scary or ugly encounters?
Yeah, you know, I really tried to take every precaution I could. It was a struggle to, at first, you know, I wanted to get access to these oil workers and be able to interview them, but they were constantly on these sites, like I mentioned, and it was, you know, it was really difficult to just meet up with them in a safe public area for coffee or something. They just didn't have that availability. So I eventually, when I met Cindy Marcello, she really became my window into this world. I mean, she introduced me to people. She told me who was trustworthy, who I should maybe stay away from. And so that really helped me feel a lot safer. But I did, yeah, I had a few, you know, just a few uncomfortable situations, like one male person that I was interviewing, he, you know, touched my leg and was kind of coming on to me during the interview, and so I had to leave the situation quickly. So things like that, you know, were definitely uncomfortable, and I was always kind of looking behind my shoulder and thinking about safety.
Sure. Cindy Marcello, you mentioned working in the oil fields, one of the few women doing that, and boy, she would not take any guff off of anyone. How would she handle a situation when she thought somebody was trying to get fresh with her?
Well, yeah, she was. She would probably make a scene. Maybe she, you know, she talked about if people were yelling on her at a site, she might spit and maybe start to throw rocks at them or threaten to throw rocks at them. So yeah, she definitely was a character.
What brought Cindy to the oil fields? Where had she come from?
So she, you know, she's 56. When she came out there, she was a grandmother. She'd recently gone through a really difficult divorce and lost her job in Utah. She was sleeping on the couches of her adult children. And so she ended up talking to a friend who was working in the oil field and just kind of telling him that she didn't know what she was going to do with her life. and he suggested that she apply to an oil company in Williston because he said, you know, it's going to take a boom to hire you because you don't have any experience. And she, you know, she thought that was crazy. She thought, there's no way I'm going to go to Williston and leave my family. But when she thought about it, she thought, well, okay, I'll at least apply. And she, you know, she really didn't have to get that much experience. She got her commercial driver's license. And with that, she was able to get hired at Halliburton in Williston.
And I should point out, you constantly use the term man camp in the book. I mean, she is really like, I don't know, what, is it 1 in 100? Is it that small a ratio of women?
Yeah, you know, there's varying estimates, but yeah, in town, I think people estimate it was like 1 to 30.
Wow. So, and I understand there's some incentive for the oil companies to hire women, particularly older women?
You know, they didn't hire a lot of women, so... Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say there was a lot of incentive. I think they thought, okay, this is good for diversity numbers, potentially. I mean, I'm not sure exactly when it went into their hiring decision, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a mention in the book of diversity hire and a chance to get some, score some points there. I don't know if it was a financial or tax incentive, but it certainly makes it a little easier for them to consider that. We're talking about the new Wild West, Blair Briotti's book about the oil fields. Here's a call from Mark in Redding. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning.
Hi.
I believe this is the third boom in that area, the first one being when they fooled people into thinking they could make it on farms in the western North Dakota and eastern Montana with the, I think it was called Badland was a book about that. And then in the early 50s, there was a standard-type oil drilling operation there in what was known as the Williston Basin. And this one is, I think, by far the largest of those three. But I'm wondering, you know, Williston is basically now a mining camp. And as soon as the mine goes dry, so will Williston. I'm wondering how long that might take.
Huh. All right. Interesting question. Thanks for that, Mark. And yes, you do point out in the book oil booms in the 50s and 80s in Williston. What happened in those?
Yeah, they went bust pretty quickly. I mean, they only lasted a few years. And when oil prices went down, everyone left. So this one's a little different. I mean, the prices have gone down significantly. They started to fall in late 2014. And they haven't come back nearly to what they were. But, you know, oil companies are always getting more efficient and finding more efficient ways to extract oil. And so they haven't stopped drilling. I mean, it's continuing. They don't have the same workforce that they did. They laid off a lot of workers. But, you know, the oil is still there. It's not going away. They know how to access it now. And so this is continuing.
Did you talk to Williston city leaders much? I mean, we talked about some of the impacts. I mean, not enough traffic lights, not enough places to live, you know, police overwhelmed for a while. I mean, do they ever talk in terms of, like, what happens if all these people leave and we're back down to where we were in population?
Yeah, there wasn't as much of that conversation as I thought there would be. I think they wanted to figure out a way to keep it there and to keep... you know, the money coming in to the town. So yeah, most people thought, okay, this is different. This is going to stay. We're going to continue to build. And, you know, the city is struggling now because so many people have been laid off and left the town, especially all these new, you know, these new apartments, new housing developments. They have this, like, ghost town feeling right now. But they're hoping, you know, everyone I talk to has a lot of optimism that people will come back.
So of the people who were there already, though, and this is where Pastor Jay Ranke is profiled in the book, he was determined to ride it out. I mean, had his flock stuck around or had some people left Williston when the new people came?
Yeah, I mean, Jay Ranke is still there. You know, he was definitely, like you said, determined to stay and try to adjust to these new changes. But a lot of people his age and a lot of the longtime locals left. I mean, they didn't like the changes that were happening to their town. Some of them had to leave. I mean, if they were renting, they simply couldn't afford to live there anymore. Some of them, you know, if they're owned, their home prices tripled or quadrupled, and so they kind of cashed in and sold their home and went somewhere else.
And how is it that Pastor Jay Reinke suggested that people treat the new arrivals?
Yeah, he wanted to welcome them. He wanted to give them a place to stay, so he opened up his church and let a lot of these new arrivals sleep on the floor, but that created a lot of controversy within his church and within the community. A lot of people didn't like that. They didn't like living next to this. They were very hesitant of new people, and like I said, didn't like the changes happening to their town.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine any town that would triple in population roughly, and that is just within the city, I guess, we're talking about, which is what happened to Williston, North Dakota, just in this decade between 2010 and the most recent numbers, a tripling in population roughly. As covered in Blair Briotti's book, The New Wild West, Black Gold, Fracking, and Life in a North Dakota Boomtown. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll take more phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about boom towns of the American West. We tend to think of those as being mineral boom towns of the 19th century, people looking for gold and silver and other minerals from the earth. But it's happening now in North Dakota in the Bakken oil field. Williston, North Dakota is the epicenter and the place where Blair Briotti went to cover people adjusting to the change, both people who'd been in Williston before and people who arrived brand new. The book is called The New Wild West, Black Gold, Fracking, and Life in a North Dakota Boomtown. You can join the conversation on the exchange, 800-838-3760, to talk about any of the issues raised by the fracking boom in the American West, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So not just oil booms brought people. I mean, back 130 years, why is Williston even there in the first place, Blair?
Yeah, exactly. Williston sprang up because of a boomtown, because of the railroad. And, so that was in its beginning.
James J. Hill on the Great Northern Railway. And, in fact, there's even still an Amtrak station there. Carrying the train between Chicago and Seattle and Portland. So the people who lived there through the decades, I mean, making a living off the land, as in farming, not what's beneath it, how hard was that for the settlers?
Yeah, it was a very difficult place to settle. You know, there's a very extreme weather. It can get down to negative 40 during the winters. It can get really hot during the summer. There's not, you know, the soil was really dense and difficult to work with. It was one of the more difficult places to be a settler.
Over the years, has Williston busted more often than it's boomed?
I mean, it's gone through a few booms, but it's stayed it stayed small, you know, like, and they were losing population for a long time.
Before this recent boom, you mean?
Right. Mm-hmm. The western part of the state has been consistently losing population over the decades, so.
Let us take another call. Here is Connie in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Blair Briotti, the author of The New Wild West.
Well, it's definitely a book I'm going to read. What I'm really interested in is something you just touched on, is that whole area has been losing population for a long time, and that means they're losing professional population, particularly doctors, nurses, lawyers, etc. And when you bring in masses of people and then masses of people in a dangerous type of work, I wondered how they developed or put into place new hospital facilities or medical facilities to deal with the influx just with regular diseases as well as the emergencies that would be a part of the oil industry.
All right, great question. Thanks for that, Connie.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, the city struggled to get doctors and nurses and enough medical personnel. You know, Williston did have a small hospital, but, you know, they were dealing with even more births than they had in the past, you know. So every department was short-staffed, and you know, doctors, they could pay enough, but you know, some of the nurses or support staff, it was housing costs were so expensive and living costs were so expensive. It was a challenge to get people to come out there to live. And then, you know, as far as the accidents on site, I mean, North Dakota became the most dangerous state to work in during the boom. And, you know, people were electrocuted on site. Sometimes they inhaled poison gases or, you know, had fatal injuries from equipment falling on them. And they, you know, there was no burn center in the area, so they had to be flown to, like, Minneapolis to be treated in some cases. So that was definitely a problem out there.
And there's a part of the book where Cindy Marcello gets injured and doesn't want to report it. Why not?
Right. There was pressure to not report accidents if they weren't really severe, because it could, you know, the company could find another reason to maybe fire you or not. You go on your record, and so it might be difficult to get hired by a company down the road. And yeah, the state, many states, including North Dakota, have been kind of slowly chipping away at the workers' compensation system. And so even, you know, if you got severely hurt out there, you wouldn't necessarily get a lot of support.
The workers don't sound particularly interested in unionizing. I was curious about that part of the book.
Right. Yeah, a lot of people I talked to out there were very hesitant of unions. I think they saw, you know, maybe their parents' generation or their own generation, get laid off in manufacturing, and they blamed unions for a lot of that. And so a lot of them were not interested. And, you know, most states where fracking and oil drilling occur are right-to-work states, which kind of have laws that take away a lot of the bargaining power in unions.
Interesting. So I don't know. That's an interesting conjunction of things. So the oil just happens to be under states where the right to unionize is not as well established.
Right.
Interesting. So let's talk about the effect on families. I mean, how many of the workers who come into Williston bring families either with them at first or later on, as happened with the knee houses?
Right. I would say for the most part, they did not bring their families. Most of the workers out there were living apart from their families, and it definitely had an impact. You know, there was a lot of marital strife, I would say. You know, affairs would happen. There was two strip clubs in downtown Williston, and so that was a big part of the culture there, was, you know, to, like, blow off steam by going to these places. And so there was a lot of distrust back home. You know, wives weren't sure what was happening, and so a lot of people struggled with their relationships. And then people who did bring their families to Williston, you know, they were hoping that they would create some stability, that they would all be together. But because the nature of this industry, I mean, there was really no guarantee that they were going to stay there. And so a lot of families struggle with that. Like, how much do they invest in this new community when they don't know how long they're going to be there?
I guess I ride sort of on the train with Chelsea Niehaus into Williston. And when she gets off the train and it's so cold, she's thinking, oh, my God, what is this place? I mean, did she ever get to a point where she felt really comfortable with the area and the town and the lifestyle?
No, I don't think she did. She struggled to make friends. She felt very isolated. She was living in a trailer park on the Native American reservation. And she didn't like it. You know, she liked having their family together. She liked that aspect of it. But she really struggled to find any sort of community or support out there.
I'm glad you brought up the Native American reservation, because there are several in North Dakota, and I just we haven't talked at all about the effect on the local folks from the tribes. Do they get hired in the oil fields, for one thing? Are they seeking jobs, and do they get them, and they seek them?
Yeah, so that was a really interesting part. I also cover some of that in the book. There's the Fort Berthold Reservation. Is really close to Williston, and they actually had a lot of drilling on the reservation. The leader at the time, he really wanted to capitalize on this oil boom. He wanted the reservation to capitalize it, and he wanted to benefit from it. And so he was very pro-oil. He wanted to, you know, get rid of some of the regulations on the reservation, make it really easy for oil companies to set up and drill. So there was drilling all over the reservation. Yes, lots of Native Americans were working on the rigs. But as far as, like, the reservation really benefiting from this, that didn't necessarily happen. I mean, a lot of the people living there didn't see the benefits. They were still living in poverty and not seeing, you know, seeing a lot of environmental damage around them.
What kinds of environmental damage?
Well, there was a spill almost every day in North Dakota, and a lot of that was from oil field brine, which is this sort of laced, it's like salty oil field waste that's laced with like chemicals that they use when they're fracking. And there was 4,000 spills, I think over like 5 years during the boom, of this oil field brine.
Mm-hmm.
And when it spills, you know, it kills everything, like all the plant life around it. It's very toxic. It's very dangerous if it gets into the water system. And so that was a big issue out there.
Donnie Nelson, who we mentioned at the beginning, he's the farmer who has lived there for several generations and didn't have the mineral rights to his land, so there were oil rigs on his farm. He seemed to endure it. Over time, did his conservation ethic kick up a little higher, and did he begin to resent them there a little more?
Yeah, I would say so. And he, you know, it was very challenging for him to maintain this, the efforts. You know, he was very vocal for a while, speaking out against, you know, the environmental damage that was happening out there. You know, one thing he says, though, he's like, I'm not against oil drilling. I just want it to be done right. I want it to be, you know, I want there to be regulation. I want, you know, oil companies to clean up the spills when they happen. I want them to do everything possible to prevent the spills from happening. So he was very vocal about that. But I think it started to get to him after a while, not feeling like he wasn't making progress. And he kind of, after a few years, you know, took more of a back seat.
Mm-hmm. A couple of listener comments here. Becca in Lane County points out that Pastor Jay Ranke, who you spent some time with for the book, was also on a TV show called The Overnighters. She said it was a really good look at an oil boom town, the pastor and his family. Thanks for that, Becca. And then here's a phone call from Seth in Central Point. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Blair Briotti, the author of The New Wild West. Go ahead, Seth.
Hi. Yeah. Sorry if I'm just tuning in here the last 15 minutes or so. So forgive me if you've already discussed this, but I feel like being in the state of Jefferson, we've seen so many boom towns around us, and it's kind of sad too. Like I come from Wairika originally, and there's a lot of, you know, like Hawkinsville and Weaverville, areas that are just, you know, pretty much all that's left is a placard of what used to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of wondering in your studies. Have you seen any improvements or maybe lessons learned from previous boom towns that they're trying to learn from in sustainability, not only in their effect on the environment, which we've seen with previous boom towns, but in sustainability of jobs afterwards? Like, do you see a lot of forward thinking in how do we keep jobs here if and when the resource busts?
Yeah, good set of comparisons. Thanks for that, Seth.
Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of improvement. You know, you think that we would be studying history more and understanding the forces that cause boom towns and what happens when they go bust. But, you know, there, I didn't see a lot of that forward thinking when I was out there. You know, a few towns, Watford City, they were really trying to do more. Like, they would have, when an apartment building, say, wanted to come in, you know, they tried to, like, really share costs, so they weren't, the city wasn't left with a lot of debt if this was to go bust. So there was some of that, but as far as, like, maintaining the jobs and preventing environmental damage, I didn't see much forward thinking in that.
So as you mentioned, it's let's make the money now and we'll deal with the rest later. You did mention a little bit about apartment, and just now, in fact, about in Watford City, about complexes getting built. So there has been an attempt to at least try to mitigate some of the crunch on housing?
Right, right, yes. There's a lot of building, a lot of new complexes and housing developments. But, you know, they struggled to be like, how much do we build? And they want, you know, Wilson especially, they wanted people to make this their permanent home. They were trying to get rid of those man camps that we talked about that were the, you know, the worker housing that were just these temporary housing structures, trailers. They were trying to keep get people away from that and to actually buy a home or rent an apartment. But, you know, when oil prices fell, a lot of people left, and so they kind of had overbuilt.
All right, so boom and bust repeated again and again over the West, and most recently now in Williston, North Dakota, in the heart of the Bakken Oil Formation. The book is called The New Wild West, Black Gold, Fracking, and Life in a North Dakota Boomtown. It's the work of Blair Briotti. Thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.